There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com. The Bookshelf, what you should be reading.
It's a little different this week as we've got the author himself on the show with us, and the book isn't even out yet. However, it is called A Tudor Turk and it's described as Mission Impossible set in the 16th century. The author is here with us, Rehan Khan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So this isn't the first book that you have written. Remind listeners of the other books that you already have to your name.
Sure. I've done two fantasy novels, which are called the Tazburai series, but this is the first historic fiction.
So this is coming out when?
It's coming out end of February.
Okay, so we do have a little while to wait still. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you to tell us as much as you possibly can about this because we have many questions. Mission Impossible, 16th century.
Sure, as you said, so it's kind of like fast-paced quest-type novel. I guess what's really important to understand is the story is set in 1591.
Okay.
What was happening? Because generally people associate that with the Tudor period and Queen Elizabeth. So if you're doing history, you look at it from the Tudor period. And I thought, what else was going on in the world at that time? And so this is the Tudors, but not like you've seen them before, right? And I figured, well, okay, so England was actually really ostracized as a country at the time. You had the Spanish Armada in 1585, and so the Catholics of Europe had got together against the Protestants, and particularly England. So in the 1590s, what did England do? It reached out to the Ottomans, who were the superpower, and it reached out to the Moroccans as well. So Protestant England's closest international ally were Muslim countries. And I thought, hey, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
What else was going on? And so the two main protagonists, one is a young lad called Will Ride, who was kidnapped when he was 5-year-old. And we find him on a Moroccan galley at the start of the novel. And the other one is a West African young woman called Awa. And that we find her at the beginning at the Battle of Tondibi in 1591. But we can talk more about that. But those are the two main protagonists in this kind of whirl and maelstrom of geopolitics, which kind of resonates with maybe what's going on in the world today as well.
It's such an interesting perspective. Because were you at school in England?
During, I was.
Yeah. And so when you learnt about history there, you learnt such an Anglo-centric view of the Tudors. It was as if nothing happened anywhere else in the world. You just focused on England as if that was all that was important. And so I love this idea that actually to everybody else, England was pretty irrelevant in many ways, or just looked down on or sneered at. And it's such a fantastic idea to approach it from that thing. And we were talking earlier, weren't we, about representation in books and kind of taking back books for characters that have been forgotten perhaps in literature in the past. And I think this is such a good example of that. I had a sneak peek of an early chapter and I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm very excited about reading the whole thing.
Are there characters that we will recognise? I imagine Queen Elizabeth is obviously featured in the book. Is Shakespeare in there?
He makes a cameo in the same scene as we find Queen Elizabeth. And of course, I had to make sure I had the right sort of dialogue for the Queen to speak. So that was a little bit, you know, it was probably quite hard to write for that period. But yes, she does make a, I mean, the story is set basically in Istanbul. It's set in Alexandria in Egypt, in Venice, and in London. So it has that kind of international feel. And it's a quest novel, so they're trying to find something.
So you're mentioning all those places, so Istanbul, Alexandria, Venice. I'm already picturing a Mission Impossible. Like, I understand the tagline now, because that is a very Mission Impossible thing where the setting is constantly changing to another city.
Mm. But it's how they get there that's really interesting as well, because obviously
probably
they can't
a lot
jump
longer
on a jet plane or anything.
Yes, exactly, yes.
Research for this, how long has this been in the works for you?
Actually, I sat down with my publisher last September in Foyle's bookshop in Charing Cross in London, and we were discussing it. And I started probably writing it in October. I started researching it in October. So it's come out pretty quickly.
Yeah,
so, I submitted the manuscript in April, May. So it took about 6 months to write. But the research was, I mean, for this kind of novel, I always tend to read a couple of academic books on history. So I actually understand the period, I understand the context. Now, of course, for instance, in this period, religion was very important. So if there's a scene in the book where the Rialto Bridge, which is in Venice, was being reopened in 1591, and I have a scene there. And I originally wrote the scene, and I was thinking, how would they open the bridge? Would they throw a bottle of bubbly at it? And I thought, well, no, of course not, because they probably have a prayer. So I kind of, you know, you have to sort of really think about the period and how do people speak and conduct themselves. Yeah. So I always find reading academic books at the beginning to get that is important. But don't get lost in the research, because you can really get lost in the research.
Yeah, and want to show it all on the page.
Yeah, so you just gotta, you've got to keep thinking about what's the story, what's the story. But it's got to be authentic, at least.
Do you have historians... I don't know how it works for historical fiction, but do you have historians actually fact-checking these books? Is that a big part of the editing process?
It is to some extent, but no, I haven't sort of sent it out to any historians to check it. And my publisher did say, are your facts all correct? Yes, they're all correct.
Yeah, so you do your question whether the publishers check? Because yes. The answer is no, actually.
Yeah.
Part of the contract that you sign as an author has a little bit in it where it sort of says, this is all your fault if you get the facts wrong.
Really?
Yes. So, I mean, exactly. I'm sure if they know somebody, they will ask them to have a look. But it is on the author to make sure that all of the information in their book is authentic and correct.
Yeah, I mean, there was one particularly dastardly Earl in the book whose name I originally wrote, and it was too similar to an existing Earl in England today. And I thought, ooh, this is a little bit risky. I better just change it. So I kind of made it a bit different.
That's funny.
It would have been a fun story if you hadn't. It would have been a really fun story. That's interesting. I had no idea that there wasn't kind of an official checking process for stuff
like this. I think if you'd written something really scandalous or controversial, then somebody would check before it went out. Mm. So you can't write anything that's potentially going to be libel, slander, which is the written one. Brain broken down. Yeah, you can't write anything that you could be sued for. And I'm sure the publisher would be all over that. But if you've got a historical novel or a novel that goes deeply into some sort of either profession or speciality, it really is, I mean, I'm sure you've had the same experience, it really is down to the author to check the
facts. I think, you know, with these kind of books, a lot of it is, you know, you kind of observe things as you move through the world. And I was in the Topkapi Palace in Istanbul. I don't know if you've been there or not.
Yes, it's amazing.
And they have one room full of old religious treasures in it. You know, there's the coat of Prophet Joseph, they have the staff of Moses, and various other prophetic kind of artifacts. And I was looking at the staff of Moses and I was thinking, I wonder how it got there. Okay. And then probably a year later, I was doing a cycle tour of Hampton Court in Kingston, in just outside London, and cycling around. And at the time I read that, you know, King Henry VIII used to love walking around dressed as an Ottoman sultan. So he would wear a turban, he'd wear long robes. And because remember, what do? You imitate the powerful.
Power, yeah.
Right. And
that
who are the most powerful people at the time? They were the Ottoman Turks, right? So, you know, everyone dresses.
Again, this is something you're taught in school in England 20 odd years ago.
So King Henry was wandering around.
Wanting to be an Ottoman.
Okay, carry
you
on.
Imitate power, right?
Yeah,
that's why always, you know, why do we dress the way celebrities dress? Because we want to be like them, right? We love them. So Henry VIII was no different. He was lower down in the pecking order in international monarchs, and he wanted to copy someone more powerful. So he used to dress like that, and I thought, that's really strange. Okay, so what's going on now during this time? And then I started looking at Shakespeare's plays and thinking, hang on a second. Before that, he's writing Henry V and all these kind of, you know, previous monarchs of England. And now suddenly in his plays, you've got a change. You've got international characters. You've got Othello. You've got in The Merchant of Venice, you have the Prince of Persia, is it?
I think so.
Or one of those. And all these different characters suddenly coming from the East. And of course, what's happening is that in the 1590s, England's closest ally are the Moroccans. And the Turks.
Such an interesting
way of looking
at things.
Theatre world, you look across literature in England, everything's changing. Coffee is introduced, you know, sugar comes in, right? This is why Queen Elizabeth's teeth went black. And all this kind of food and spices are coming down the Silk Roads into England, Right. And no one, as you said, Liz, earlier, Rachel, no one is really treating England very seriously until the Spanish Armada. And after that, Elizabeth had a reputation as this queen who defeated the Spanish. Now, of course, you know, a lot of it was the weather and, you know, bad coordination
no,
on the Spanish side.
Not when you
side.
Learn history.
but at the court of the Moroccan king, Mansour, his official poet, he wrote a poem for Elizabeth. And said that, you know, God sent a hawa, a wind, to protect the English during that time. So it was really after they defeated the Spanish that her reputation internationally went up. And then suddenly you had other powers thinking, oh, we should ally these people as well.
We've been talking quite a bit about the research that has gone into this book, which is being described as Mission Impossible set in the 16th century. We've spoken about King Henry VIII walking around in Ottoman attire. And I wondered, we've only just briefly touched on the research that was involved in the writing of this book. Do you have any other anecdotes from your researching times that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, I think what I really enjoy doing is looking at how different cultures and civilizations have taken ideas from others and then built them up. Because nothing happens in a vacuum, right? Nothing happens in a vacuum. It's always this kind of cross-cultural learning and looking at the histories and the legends and the myths and the ideas that belong to one culture, and how did that this sort of go across to another. And so when I'm doing the research, and particularly in this book, because I've got elements of, you know, West African culture there, there's obviously the Tudors, there's the Ottomans, and how did the literature and the language of one influence the other. So for example, when you see Elizabeth the First wearing a lot of really kind of flouncy clothing, that was actually sent by the Ottoman Sultan's mother, who sent these dresses to Elizabeth, and then she wore them and had portraits done. That wasn't the style of the period. That was, you know, a lot of that was sent. In return, Elizabeth actually sent an organ to Sultan Murad III in 1599, I think it was. And she also sent the organ player as well, Thomas Dalhem, who was responsible for building lots of the great organs of cathedrals in the UK. And so I think I can't remember which ones he did, so I don't want to quote which ones he did. But anyway, this poor fellow went across to Istanbul. On the ship, the way across, the organ sort of got broken. And then when he got to Istanbul, he spent about 3 months reassembling this organ, tuning it, and then played, you know, for the Sultan and his family. And I think she also sent a carriage as well. And I think the best carriages in the period were German carriages were the best ones. And of course, German cars are still the best today, which kind of, you know, gets you thinking, well, this must be something in the German psyche about building excellent transportation. So all these gifts were going back and forward between the English court and the Ottoman court as well.
That's so interesting about the impact on fashion. When you say it, it makes absolute sense, but it's not something that had ever occurred to me before. You need to be on some sort of YouTube channel constantly informing people.
Because in my head, and I think this goes back to kind of the way we learn history in schools in a very kind of potted, condensed format, that I always associate Elizabethans, and I think a lot of people do, with, you know, ruffs, with that fashion, not knowing that, you know, it was
that there were influences,
other influences happening behind the scenes.
Well, even if you look at the coffee shops of the period, right, you can find old maps with old coffee shops around London, and the coffee shops are called what? A Turk's Head, Saracens, this, blah blah blah. They're all coffee shops. They're pubs now, they're public houses, but they were coffee shops during that period.
And they all sprang up at that time.
Because coffee came over. You know, coffee was found in Ethiopia, then it went to Yemen. From Yemen, it went to Arabia. From Arabia, it went to Cairo. From Cairo, it came into Istanbul. And then from there, it came to the West. And, you know, there's a whole history of coffee. So all of the coffee shops there were named after Eastern names, and some
like
of them
like a really
still exist.
Interesting Big Red Bus tour. I love this. I didn't know that either. I feel very ignorant, but happily so, because now I'm newly informed
in a good way. Yeah.
So these are all like really interesting kind of things you pick up when you're doing the research.
What's a piece of research that didn't make its way into the book? And were there ever any bits of research where you kind of had to fight to say, no, I really, really want to include this, and maybe the publisher was like, no, just leave it for the second book?
I think it was there was a couple of battles that took place during that time that I really wanted to include. So there was one epic battle, which is called the Battle of the Four Kings. And it took place, I think it was in this period of slightly like 5-6 years before this, when my story is set in 1591. And it was between the Moroccan king, and it was between the Portuguese, the Spanish, and there was one more king. There was basically four kings. And this battle took place around the kind of, I think it was around Malta at that area. All four kings died. Okay. And I really wanted to put that in because I just thought, God, that was so Lord of the Rings-esque, you know, the Battle of the Four Kings. It's an amazing.
Well, it sounds
battle.
Like the title of one of the Hobbit films, Battle of the Five Armies.
Yeah, exactly. And I just couldn't bring that in because the timing wasn't working on that one. I thought, no, that's bending time a bit too much, really. But what I did do is that one of the reasons why in 1591 the Moroccans came down and actually invaded West Africa was because they were bankrupt at the time. You know, they had this Battle of the Four Kings, lost all their money in their fight with the Portuguese and the Spanish. And so they came down and they actually attacked this part of West Africa where there was a civilization called the Songhai. And the Songhai were probably the greatest African civilization. They were there for about 250 years. Their capital, their intellectual capital, was Timbuktu, of where there was a great university, great scholarship, and their commercial capital was Gao. Today it's like Mali, it's that area. Mm-hmm. So the Moroccans came down, they attacked the Songhai, unfortunately, you know, wiped them out. And both were Muslims, actually. Songhai were Muslims and Moroccans are Muslims as well. And so the second chapter in the book starts with the Battle of Tondibi in 1591, and one of the other characters is there. But I really wanted to include some other battles, and I just thought, I can't do it.
I know you're working on the second book. How many are actually planned?
Three are planned.
All with the same two key protagonists.
Yes. So the actual novel title, you can see there, Rachel, it says The Chronicles of Will Ride and Awa Maryam Al-Jamil, who are the two protagonists, Will and Awa. And the first book is called The Tudor Turk. Yeah.
And it will be out in February. What date?
I think it's 21st of February.
It's my daughter's birthday. I'll remember that. What's interesting is you just come across as a true storyteller, because on your travels you kind of magpie information and then suddenly start to connect them together. And I think that's what makes the story of the story really interesting. Mm-hmm. And we were talking very briefly before about school visits and prison visits that you had planned. Have you already kind of planned out in your head the kind of things you'll cover and the way that you'll cover them?
Generally, when I do a school visit, there's two things I'll do. One is I'll talk about how to design a novel, because there's a lot of advice about how to write a novel, but there's very little advice about how to design a novel. They're two separate things. And I'm actually doing a workshop at the LitFest as well.
Yes, on Emirates Airline Festival of Literature, happening 1st and 9th of March. Please continue.
So I'll be doing one there. And then the other thing I'll be talking about on school visits is really how do you tell a story? Yeah. And especially like historic fiction, what are the elements that go into that? So there are two things I'm generally doing. So a workshop on designing novels, and then how do you actually tell a story, particularly historic fiction.
Can we get a sort of sneak peek of the content, especially because your workshop sounds like it's a bit because I'm doing a really boring one about how to write a novel, and now I feel really old school.
Not boring at all, because you're in it, Rachel.
I'm half joking, because I do think it'll be fabulous.
Exactly.
But in terms of how to design a novel, without giving all the spoilers of your workshop away, what kind of thing do you cover?
Okay, so there are three tools a writer has: setting, character, and plot to work with, right? And what you need to do, as you know, Rachel, is you need to put tension and conflict into your setting, conflict into your characters, and conflict into your plot. And when you do that, you get an emotional response from the reader. And so the workshop is, how do you design your setting, characters, and plot, fuse them with conflict,
so you get
an emotional response from the reader. And that's what it's about.
Oh, very interesting. Yes, I like that.
I'd like to finish up, because we've got about a minute left. There have been quite a few wonderful reviews of A Tudor Turk, Rohan, and I want to read one of them out, or at least in part. This is from Naomi Foyle, author of the Gaia Chronicles. She says, three huzzas for this scintillating new take on the late Tudor period, a rip-roaring, erudite page-turner that sets British history in its wider cosmopolitan context, celebrating the intertwined civilizations and faiths of three continents, while sharply interrogating the moral codes that drive the spread of empires. Enslaved far from the lands of their births, you have Will, a young English swordsman, and Aiwa, a noble West African warrior woman, who must prove themselves no pawns in a ruthless geopolitical game of power and prestige, ultimately battling their own torn loyalties to reach new understandings of home. Though Ottoman scimitars and Elizabethan daggers glint at every dark corner, Rehan Khan's gripping tale is peppered with the wisdom of ages and glows with the ruby light of a compassionate heart, a jewel no snaggle-toothed queen or vainglorious sultan can buy.
Exciting.
She gets marks for the word snaggle-toothed.
it's very well written, isn't it? But I mean, on a serious point, you've got a lot of positive attention already for this novel, haven't you? So it sounds like there are great things to come.
I hope so.
I have one final slightly silly question. And that's because we've mentioned Mission Impossible set in the 16th century so many times. I presume you'd be on board with a film adaptation.
Oh, of course. Why not? And let's go and talk to Tom Cruise, definitely.
Can you actually see him in any of these parts?
Possibly, yes.
Possibly, yes.
The guy in charge of the oar guys downstairs in the galleon.
Thank you so much, Rehan, for joining the show to talk about A Tudor Turk with us. And we look forward to seeing you at the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature next year. So when we come back, we played I've Had the Time of My Life from Dirty Dancing on the show last week in honour of all the celebrating. Stop giggling, Rachel. In all of all the celebrating we were doing. National Day, the upcoming festive season, quite frankly, the cooler weather, which is amazing. And of course, all the wonderful authors coming to the Emirates Airline Festival of Literature next year.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.